Blog Talk Radio.
Today we have Brittany Powell and Tom Conkle, and we're going to be talking about Trouble Is My Business. It's a really good movie. I've already seen it twice. I really recommend it. Hi, Brittany. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us on, and I'm so glad you liked the movie.
I'm so glad you've seen it twice.
Yeah, I just really...
Did you see it?
The first time I saw it by myself, and the second time I dragged my brother over to watch it, too. And he actually liked it. But
was it sort of, hey, I think this is good. Do you agree?
No. He really liked it. He just was in the middle of watching. He was watching it some other show. You gotta see this. Come on.
That's wonderful. I'm glad you liked it. I'm curious. Did you watch the color or the black and white?
The black and white.
Yeah.
Score.
That's the way to go.
Yeah, if you're going to watch film noir, you have to watch in black and white.
I agree. It's an interesting story, actually. It was shot to be black and white. Obviously, we had to shoot color for effects considerations, you know, like set extensions and things needed to have color in them so that we could key things in. But it was always meant to be black and white. The pushback happened really late in the production. As I was getting ready to deliver, most streaming companies will not accept a black and white film anymore. And part of that is a mandate that they have. Like, for example, Netflix will not carry movies, most movies, prior to 1960. So if you go onto Netflix right now, there are no, you know, old movies that you can go look at that are in black and white. And what they're doing is clearing a lot of their libraries of a lot of the classics because they just happen to be in black and white. And I had wanted to release it in dual, you know, like we did with the disc and like we are doing with the Blu-ray. The Blu-ray of the black and white is gorgeous, but you can't get it on a streaming system because all of them are like, no, black and white, no way. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, you don't show Dr. Strangelove?
How about The Artist? Nope. How about The Artist? That was the Oscar-winning movie in black and white.
You sound like me during the pitch. How about The Artist a couple years ago? That kind of did well. couple hundred million. Yeah. Well, that's foreign, and that's silent. But another person told me.
That's silent. Yeah. Turn our volume down then.
Yeah, a person actually told me, isn't black and white more expensive?
What? Yes, because we have to pay somebody to paint out all the color.
Yes. Isn't that funny?
That is nuts. I mean, I'm sorry. If you watch black and white movies, you have missed some of the best movies ever made, ever. Some Like It Hot.
Agreed.
Was done in black and white. I mean, come on.
I know. Agreed. It's a kind of culture where which movie is more new is more important than which movie is better. Which is why they have a new release, area on all the streaming services. And they used to have it in video stores where you'd go in Blockbuster and it would say new releases. And I used to move old movies onto the new release shelf. And I would just watch people go over and grab them because they thought it was new. And I actually had a lady come up to me and she had a Jean-Claude Van Damme film in one hand and she had Citizen Kane in the other. And I thought she was going to go, which one of these is good? And she goes, excuse me, sir, you look like you know movies. Which one of these is new? And I said, Citizen Kane. And she remembered it right there. Absolutely true.
Oh, my God. How funny. Oh, my God. You are mean.
And this is why we love taking Tom in public.
Under supervision, of course. Yeah, it's funny. No, Brittany and I always meant it to be black and white. You know, that it was shot that way. When I was designing the lighting plots for it and composing it, it was to use the negative space that the darkness created. It was to show the relative, you know, distance between the characters, lighting, all that was predicated on it being in black and white. And so I had to devise a color system that kind of did the same thing where I had to figure out, well, when it's nighttime, it needs to have this particular color. And when you're inside, it needs to have this warm tungsten sort of hue to make you feel like it's one step removed from reality. It's a little dreamlike because black and white is a distancing effect by nature. When you look at a black and white photo, you're seeing an abstraction of a person because the color information is not there. That's sort of what I like. Projected black and white is beautifully dreamlike.
It's beautiful. It's beautifully shot, beautifully acted, beautifully written. I loved it. It reminded me somewhat of like Maltese Falcon or The Big Sleep, something like that. It's that style.
You know, Tom made me watch all of those movies, like binge watch all of those movies, and taught me so much about film noir before we started writing this, just so that I could get that, like you said, the Maltese Falcon was one of them.
Yeah, it was research. She was just like a sponge. She was kind of like, I haven't seen some of these. And then she started digging it, and we both kind of used it to inform the way that we were writing. And the best stuff, I think, is a remix or a reformulation of what our interpretation was. So because we were watching it together, we were both revisiting it and kind of going, I like that, and I like this about it. And it informed our acting, which, you know, we really tried to hone the acting down to being believable, but period appropriate. You know, people acted, there was a sense of decorum in the acting that needed to be in the performance. A lot of these movies fall down because you look at them and it looks like a dress-up play. It's sort of like, you know, modern-day woman dressing up like an old-fashioned character, but the way she carries herself and the way she talks is too contemporary, if that makes any sense. Like, that was my problem with Gangster Squad, is it felt like Emma Stone was a contemporary character play-acting at being in it. And what I liked about Brittany is she inhabited it in a way that she became refined and she became this
that
character.
That was the real acting job.
That was the acting job right there. But what really gave the authenticity to it is I think that with some distance, it won't date it as much because you won't go, oh, that's them play acting at it. It was, no, what would it have been like if we really were in that period?
Do you have a fedora?
It was really
well
done.
It's not fedora without a fedora. Thank you.
No, the fedora.
Yeah, for me, the acting was everything.
Ours is the hats. I love the hats of the period. They were so sexy and gorgeous, for both for men and women. I wish they'd bring hats back because they're just so cool.
I do too. I'm a hat man. In fact, my granddad has this picture with the fedora. Basically, it's the same fedora I'm wearing in the movie, and he just looks like such a gangster. He looks great, and there was something refined about it. Like men dressed to go out and do something, and women dressed and thought about it, which is it makes it classic.
I wear hats when I don't want to wash my hair.
I learned that when I was a little girl. There was a book out called Forever. I was a little girl. I was a preteen. And in it, she didn't wash her hair, so she asked for a hat because she was going to see a guy she liked. And I went, oh, that's a good idea. And from then on, I always wore hats whenever my hair was dirty.
I love it.
Yeah, you know, if you see me with a hat on, it's because I didn't want to take a shower.
Yep. I am wearing a hat now.
He is wearing a hat right now.
Is
totally
it a fedora?
It's a fedora.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's the fedora.
Totally. He's wearing a jogging suit, but he's got a fedora on, so it's total film noir.
It was believable until the jogging suit.
That is really funny.
Well, I'm so pleased you like the look of the film and the acting. That means a lot to me, having, you know, directed it and having the actors there. That was the most important thing, more than anything else.
Oh, yeah. I think I've told you privately, I'm a huge film noir fan. I mean, one of my favorite movies, which they kind of play a little too much on TCM, but still one of my favorite movies is Laura. It's like the perfect noir murder mystery because it just you didn't know what was going to happen, but everybody was so elegant and gorgeous. It was just
and I love the kind of supernatural element of him falling in love with her thinking she's dead, which is a great idea.
I know, and that painting of Jean Tierney, it just, wow. I always wondered.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'm a huge fan of her.
Yeah, but I always wondered if Jean Tierney kept a copy of it.
She should. It was a beautiful painting. And that's another one that uses the sort of Hitchcockian touch of you show, you know, you have the shotgun that's in the grandfather clock, and you build tension by everything that's happening around it, and it kind of leads inextricably to the way it's going to end, but it's so fatalist because it's noir.
Didn't you think it was interesting that Dana Andrews, like, he punches a hole in the clock at Clifton Webb's house, but at Gene Tierney's scene, he looks for the release so he could find the right... and it's set up perfectly, because it's...
Like, yeah, wait a minute. Yeah.
I might kill you, but I still have to be a gentleman about it.
Yeah, so, you have to do it the right way.
And that was Clifton Webb's movie.
I'm sorry.
He had never made a movie before. Did you
see
that?
Oh, he had never made a movie before? Wow.
Yeah, he was very well-known actor, but that was his first film.
Oh, perfect casting. I mean, casting's everything. When we were writing it, literally we heard people's voices in our head that were actors we wanted to work with, like Giordano, who played the mom. We heard that voice as we were writing it, and that informed the character because some people just are so perfect as a fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't that weird? You just
it is.
You can't imagine anybody else playing the part. It's just, that's why Brittany and you are in your parts, is because you can't imagine. I mean, well, you wrote it too, that helped. But but you can't imagine
anybody
else. I
wrote it with my
voice
in mind.
Yes. It did play to our strengths. I always joke with her, if we were in the 40s and 50s, she and I would just rule. As far as this, there's something about us. That's what I love working with her, is that she can be a chameleon and fit into whatever. And she fit beautifully as a 40s femme fatale. It's like she was genetically designed to do it, and I was just lucky to have her.
Aw. You guys are making me blush.
You're both so good, but
you
were amazing as both characters. Brittany has a dual role. She plays sisters. And she was so different as each person, even though you knew it was her. It was so well done. Really great.
Thank you so much. I have to give Tom a lot
you
of credit,
great
too. sorry, what? More compliments?
She was going to compliment me.
The greatest brunette,
too. Yeah, well, yeah, we were messing around with that wig, and we found that look, and she really, I mean, it was really easy to direct her, but she also trusted me. And I think we found a nice rhythm of making some distinctions between them. Even it's interesting between the interactions of the character, even, you know, the love scenes are very different. Like the other one is much more aggressive and there's one that's much more tender, and it reveals the character, but it often surprises you because it's not what you expect. It's revealing the characters through action and how they feel about each other, but it's actually the flip sometimes. And I like that, by not saying what you are, we just kind of show you. That's always more interesting.
And I think that's more, that's a different era where people were able to use their imagination more. I think that's really cool. And we need that. We need to reintroduce the fact that people have imaginations, and you should be able to pick out stuff from watching clues from their body motion and the way they look at something and hand gestures and all that. It's something that is needed to bring more of it back into acting again, instead of everything being so damn verbal. And I'm a writer.
I agree with you. I think in a small way, it's because with technology now, people interact with each other without being in the presence of each other. And so kids, when they get together to play, will do it online playing a game, and they miss the subtleties of body language. They miss the touch, taste, smell of picking up from someone what they're saying, or they're texting each other, not even talking. Like when I was growing up, you called your friends. You know, you actually heard their voice. But now a month or two can go by where people just talk in text, or they just talk online. And I think that informs the movie, where you sometimes don't see that as being a necessary component of the way people communicate.
Oh, that's probably, we should write that for our next movie. We should just, like, as I'm talking to Tom, I'm not going to use any tone. I'm not going to use any body language, but we're going to superimpose emojis over my head, thought bubbles.
Yeah, we'll actually see the text above her head.
And without it, Tom will be blank, like, what is she thinking?
Yeah.
Is that a yes or a no?
Yeah, you just see an emoji come up that says context. Yeah.
God.
You know, what I loved about Drake is it gave me a chance to play someone that I would enjoy playing given a casting opportunity, but I also liked kind of inhabiting a guy who was an everyman, but he's the guy for me that is your friend who is heading towards a brick wall, and you know he's heading to that brick wall, but how he gets there and hits it is the interesting part. It's not a whodunit, it's sort of a why done it. And I loved playing him because there was a stillness to him. Sometimes when Brittany's character would say something to me, he would hold back, and he almost wouldn't move, and you impose your own reactions and feelings on him because you know he's squirming underneath when she's like, hey, well, you were with my sister, but he gives her nothing back, but that's everything. Because in real life, when people get freaked out or scared or something, they often shut down. They don't go like, oh, I'm scared, this is crazy. They just stop moving, and they kind of look, and you impose so much meaning on it.
That's something a lot of actors that I've seen, that I've interviewed, and I've also seen being interviewed say, that they wanted to put a stillness into the character. And I understand it because I've acted, but could you expand on that for people in the audience who don't really know what that means?
I think when I'm directing, I often tell people, think loudly. And what I mean by that is if your character is still, it gets all the busyness out of the character. The physicality sometimes can be distracting. And if you find that still center, that's the vulnerability that the best performances come from. I don't think you can give a good performance without being vulnerable. If you have too much of the, you know, I need to look cool, I need to be this, I need to be that. If you have a stillness to you, often the emotions that are in the script can get imprinted on your character because you didn't make a decision for the audience already. Like if I'm looking at Brittany and she becomes still, but in the context of the story, she is deeply sad. She's just lost something, but she isn't emoting like she is now. Then I think that stillness is thinking loudly, and I think people do resonate. It's what you throw at the audience, but also what you throw at the other character. You know, when I'm acting with her, something that's beautiful, it's like tennis. You play with someone better than yourself. So I challenge myself, and I'll be playing a scene with her, and I can throw my energy to her, and I can trust her that she's going to throw it back to make me look good. Like she ups my real estate by doing that. But I try and do that for her too, because it, just like comedy is about making the other person funny, in a drama, it's about making the emotions and what's going on underneath the character more clear by how you're reacting to them. So you'll notice when I cut to someone, it's not just for no reason to break up a scene. You try and have it play out in a two-shot. And you try and have whatever happened in front of the camera happen with as little intervention as possible, because that's sort of how they shot then. But more importantly, now we tend to cut to every single time, you know, someone talks, cut to head, cut to this, cut to that. And in this movie, we tried to trust it a bit. And I think that stillness allows the scene to play without the kind of fidgety distractions that a lot of films have where they just don't trust the material. If you look at something and it needs to be dollying in a 180 the entire time and flash cutting on every single gesture, it means that there wasn't anything underpinning it. So sort of that's my answer to the stillness, is that that's in service of the story and character simultaneously.
And also with the acting, if you can just calm your body down, you know, get rid of some of that nervous energy and tension. And that's a lot of times where the actors start getting non-still, where they start getting fidgety. But that's expending energy that should be behind the eyes. It should be pointed directly at the other character. So if you start getting too movement-oriented, you're not really acting. In, you know, that internal energy is not able to come out in a way that I think would be more interesting and more appropriate than just having all this weird busyness and letting your energy go over here and over there. You know, you keep it right on the other character or
you know, at camera or whatever, it's just, it's far more interesting to watch that way, in my opinion. It's far more interesting to act that way. You know, you can tap into your emotions more appropriately if you're not haphazard.
I think that's very interesting. One thing that I'm a classic movie fan, which is not a shock to you guys, I think. One thing I think that I loved old movies is that everything showed in their eyes. Humphrey Bogart, Natalie Wood, Gary Cooper, Cary Grant, all of them, you just saw everything in their eyes. They didn't even have to say anything. I mean, like, the scene in North by Northwest when he's in the field and he's about to get the just before the crop duster thing comes, it's a fear, the confusion. It's all in his eyes. He doesn't have to say anything. He doesn't even have to make a movement. It's all there. And I love that. That's one of the reasons I love watching old movies, is because you see that much more than you see it in modern stuff.
That is true. And that goes right to the heart of the Thinking Loudly philosophy that I tried to embrace in this and I will embrace going forward. One thing that I like to have happen on set is I'll have ideas, like when I'm watching it, and Brittany will back me up on this, I'll have like an idea and we'll switch something up and we'll let it happen, but then I'll be like, do this one thing, like look at him when you're talking about her, and you know, we shift the way it goes, but then you let it play. And if you watch this movie on the big screen, you realize it's all about the faces. And there's that famous quote, was it, we had faces then? You know, when they talk about acting, they're like, well, we had faces then. And when I saw it projected in Virginia, we actually were in a festival in Virginia. I saw it up on the big screen, and literally I realized what I was always favoring was the tight, you know, tight close-up faces, either a two-shot or a single, that told the entire story. I very rarely went wide. And that was just instinctual in the way I was shooting. I didn't really shoot anything I didn't use. I didn't have that luxury. We were doing often 8-9 pages a day. So I saw it in my head, and then I had to translate it out. And most people thought it, hopefully, effortless because because you, at the end of the shoot, you'd be like, he got everything. And we didn't fight, and we didn't yell, and there was no panic. How did that happen? I'm like, well, I've already seen the movie. I'm just retranscribing it. I already see all of it. Like, I had everything memorized. So it's just, that, at that point, it was just getting it down again because I already knew what it looked like.
That's why it's so great. I think that's why it's so great, because you had it all in your mind. You knew what you were. You knew what you wanted. You were just capturing it, and I loved it. I thought it was brilliant.
Watching Tom on set, being both director, lighting director, actor, all of that, it was honestly inspiring. It was like watching a conductor, you know, make an orchestra, create beautiful music, and just fluid. It was seamless to watch him go from behind the camera to in front of the camera. And even when he was in front of the camera, people would have questions, and he was just saying, it was already in his head. He didn't have to go back and refer to notes, but he would reset everything so that they understood, oh, now we understand the look you're trying to get here. And it was so seamless. It really truly was like watching a conductor with an orchestra. It was so beautiful. So kudos to you, Tom.
Thank you. One of my fondest memories, Sherry, was that, yeah, well, thank you. One of my fondest memories is we were at the automobile place with the car, and Brittany's sitting over to the side, and I'm setting up a car shot, and I put a 50mm on, and they were doing a silk over the car and whatever I wanted. And I just look over at Brittany, and I can see her, and she's like, Tom is just so happy right now. She said to the line producer on it, she's like, look at him. And I was, and it made me happy that she noticed it. And, like, she, you know, I know that's authentic, because she could tell that that's when I was the most alive, is I sort of came on when that was happening, because to me it isn't work. I mean, it's work, but it's work with a purpose. And this film was made by friends that met with a purpose. We got together going, let's do the best we can, and let's cast ourselves in a way that no one else gave us permission. Fine, we give ourselves permission. We're going to do this our way, and we're going to elevate people that we knew could carry a movie.
I think that's
nobody
awesome.
Giving us permission is the theme of my life. I never have permission to do anything. I just did it.
That's right. That's just true. She's good for me that way.
I think it's really cool because one of the things I think that was exciting is to see somebody in a characterization that you'd never seen them before. And the femme fatale, I never saw you as one before, Brittany. It was really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really, it was something in retrospect that you're like, duh, yeah. But when I started it, she hadn't had an opportunity to play a classical character like that. And she's so obviously a casting choice. It's like I would tell any casting director now, it's like, hire Brittany. She's perfect for that.
Yeah, hire me.
Brittany at BrittanyPell.com.
No, but I loved it. I really did. I think that one of the things that I thought interesting was that it was old Los Angeles. How did you capture old L.A.? Is it all studio?
He captured it in the jar with fireflies.
Which part are you saying? That's rather poetic. Are you saying capture the interiors or the exteriors?
Interiors.
The interiors?
No, exteriors.
That's a mix. Oh, exteriors. It's still a mix. A lot of the exteriors were actually shot on location. For example, there's a scene in a cemetery, and we did some research and found a cemetery that was period appropriate. It didn't have too many modern mausoleums and headstones and things, and it actually worked quite well. Anytime that we see an exterior establishing shot, a lot of those buildings are, you know, real buildings that have been this. One thing that I did do is there's a lot of cleanup in the exteriors. Mike Smith, the executive producer on this, has a facility with visual effects that I had a certain mandate, which is when you're downtown, I wanted to see the cable cars. I wanted to feel the environment. And there was a cleanness to the environment back then. And we tried our best with the resources that we had to create an overall feeling to the exteriors that it's slightly a heightened reality version of it. But often it's sort of a photographic composite of you know, using CGs and you know, actual photos to create a basic look to the film. So the exteriors were well researched, and nothing in them I wanted to sort of clash with it. So I replaced, you know, every parking meter, everything that didn't fit with the world had to go. And then we were lucky enough that a lot was CG and a lot was just digital replacement, like erasing it from the shot frame by frame. No, CG is creating something in the frame. Rotoscoping is removing what's in the frame. We need to come to more meetings.
This is how we get Anne, Brittany. This is how we get Anne.
She needs to come to some meetings. Yeah. But that's really
the
exteriors.
Where did you, was that like old footage? Because my mom told me when she first came to L.A., she came for a visit, and she told me one of the coolest thing was the cable cars there back then.
No, those are created from scratch. Yeah.
That's CG.
Okay. Yeah, they're hand animated, 24 frames a second. They're actually based on a European design that was close to the design of the 1940s Angel Flight cart. And then I found color references that I gave to Mike of how they were painted originally, and we matched the paint. And then they were hand animated going behind Brittany and I as we were talking. And then you'll notice on the marquee behind it, there's an Easter egg, which is Hang My Gallows High is playing at the movie theater, and that's the book that Out of the Past was based on.
Oh, how cool. I didn't know that. How cool.
There's tons of Easter eggs in this thing. If you look very closely, there's a ton of references inside. And that particular shot, Mike worked on for almost a month, and it involved 7,000 polygons. So it was about 10,000 files that all had to be rendered.
Baby frog.
Polly
pollywogs. What?
We call them pollywogs for Brittany's benefit. She's like, how many tadpoles long is this? Yeah. Yeah, to Mike Smith's credit, you know, Mike Smith really helped me realize the vision, because there was no way to make this in all the mansions and all the locations with the money that we had without his intervention. So we kind of engineered the entire film to kind of have it. You don't notice what's missing, that you don't have a huge budget, but you kind of value engineer it to go, for what I see in this frame, it's as densely packed a layer cake as possible. And once we color graded it, you kind of believe everything is inside its environment, but it's not supposed to be completely real. It's supposed to be like an old movie where it's almost hyper real.
Yeah, I can. I saw that. I thought you were very clever on a lot of the things for the interior shots, especially when you were doing the dinner scene. That was really cool.
Yeah. Well, the thing that was most important to me was the fireplace. Actually, the sound and the image of it, it grows angrier and more intense as a fire behind the mom, depending on what she's saying as a line of dialogue. And then over her head, when she's talking about the husband, he's actually looming over her shoulder in that portrait, looking over it, which is my Laura tribute. That's from Laura.
I remembered that, but I didn't realize that's what you were doing. Okay, that's really cool.
There's not one scene that isn't, everything isn't there on purpose, because I could control everything in the frame.
That is really cool. Yeah, I love that. I love the way it was shot. I love the whole, it was such a clever, the whole movie's clever, but I think that was one of my favorite scenes, was the dinner scene. That was just so well done.
Mine
so
too.
Cool.
As a scene, it works really well, and as a structure in noir or even a murder mystery, there's always that scene where you literally set the table with the cast of characters. You know, they do it in Murder on the Orient Express. They're eating and you meet all the characters seated. I think with this, it was a perfect organic way for us to learn everything we need to know about everyone going forward, but there's so much being said. The empty chair where one of the sister would be is symbolic. We have the interaction where you see a little bit of affection from Johnny towards her. You see his hand go to her back. You see the dynamic between her and her mother. You see how Drake is the outsider. He's seated, the only one alone on one side of the table, who's in charge of the family. She's at the head of the table. And then how it unbalances when Barry Tate comes in, the detective. He comes in, turns the chair around, which is turning the scene around, and then he sits down at it, and he unbalances the composition because he never sits. And there's a lot of things in this where characters, if you watch the opening, whoever's seated above or below has the power. So when she first walks in, she sits down on the desk over Drake. Then they equalize, then she sits below him in the chair, and then when she finally gets him ensnared and goes, I want your help, she stands and they stand as equals together, and it ends with them on the same level. And that same thing is repeated again. You'll notice the pencil always falls before the femme fatale walks in, so he's on his knees looking down, getting the pencil, when the blonde walks in.
That's right, on your knees!
I wonder whose idea that was. Brittany kept saying that. And that, again, is the power, because you'll notice she stands at the beginning of that scene where she's holding the gun on him. He's seated. And then when they equalize at the window, she sits down and he sits next to her at the same level, and it ends with him standing over her. So if you watch the movie with the sound off, you should know the relationships of each one of the characters by the way I compose the shot.
I do have one question. What was the relationship between the detective and the mother? There was something there during that scene, but I've watched it twice. Were they lovers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's an interesting question. I think when he's like, I just want to help you, Evelyn, I think it's the only time he's soft in the whole movie. And one does have to wonder.
And he was doing business with my father, too. So he was slightly familiar with our family without really knowing our family. And so, you know, having done business with my dad, who's now missing, he understands a little bit of that. So I think that's another reason why he's a little bit softer with her.
He's also an alpha male, and he's filling a spot that has been vacated by the loss of Wilson. So there's a lot going on. You definitely picked on there are some things to pick up on in that scene that you picked up on, because he softens when he turns to her to help you, Evelyn, but there's menace under that softness. But you'll notice she's like, the police are doing everything they can. And that's when she gets emotional talking about the police. He's the police. So you can kind of draw whatever conclusions from that.
It struck me because he was such a jerk through most of the movie, and then all of a sudden he's almost human there, and then it goes away.
Yes, and we had that in mind when we wrote this together. We played all the parts out loud. It was kind of fun. Some of my fondest memories are she and I would sit together and read all the parts as we sort of heard them. And that was always a scene where he had a little bravado in him, and he had a little softness where he was like, I want to help you, Evelyn. You know, and that's not the cadence or the way he's usually barking orders and doing things. He's a man of words, you know, telling people what to do. But there's a certain softness when he turns to her. So, yes, he would have to be charming to be as powerful as he is. And so he knows who to suck up to.
Interesting. Yeah, I wanted to ask about that.
Yeah, well spotted. And to Vernon's credit, he trusted implicitly. I have a funny story. Can I tell you about him?
No, we don't want to hear it. This is not what this show is about, telling stories. No. Yeah.
Okay, Sherry.
No,
so you'll love
is.
This. Because if you wrote this in a book or a movie, you'd be like, okay, no way. When I moved out here, I had acted back east and just gotten out of film school, and so naturally I needed money. So I went and I took a job as Christmas help at Circuit City, which was an electronics store. And the first celebrity I ever met walking in 1989 was Vernon Wells. And here's young Tom, you know, little 20-year-old Tom going, oh my God, it's Vernon Wells. And I come up to him and I talk to him, and I'm like, at the end of the conversation, for real, I go, one day I am going to do something with you. And he's like, yeah, okay, whatever, kid. Because he had just done, you know, Commando and The Road Warrior and all these big movies. So flash forward 23 years, we're sitting at a commercial audition, and we get cast together. We're on a safari, and he's leading the safari, and I'm the guy who's on the safari. And I turn to him, and I go, do you remember a kid coming out? And he's like, no. And I go, I told you 23 years ago we'd be doing something. I'm doing a movie. Are you free for lunch? And flash forward about 6 months, he's interrogating me in the chair, and I look up, and I'm like, I did it. It only took me 24 years to do a film with the first person I ever met in L.A. that I recognized as an actor. How random is that?
That is really cool. He's a wonderful actor, and just wonderful in the film.
Yeah, he was a perfect choice for that.
And he is one of the sweetest men you'll ever meet in person. He's funny. He's like that clever wit, but it's subdued. So sometimes you're like,
he's bone dry.
Was he just making fun of me? And if so, that was good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. With a lot of people that play villains well, when the mask comes off, they're actually in the other direction far more. Like, he does animal rescue, wolves rescue. He builds hospitals and schools for children in other countries. I mean, he's just this wonderful guy. I recently had lunch with him, and he was telling me about going to India and building a school for kids. And it's like, what he's able to do is tap into that deep stream of the darkness that he sees in humanity and channel it. But then I think he purges it by doing those characters, because he's known for playing villains, but when you talk to him, he's like, hey, mate, how you doing? I was just helping some kids out.
Yeah, very first time I ever met him, it wasn't handshakes, it was hugs.
Yeah.
He's just
you don't
sweet.
Expect it.
He's so sweet.
That's funny, because
it's a pleasure getting to know him.
When I grew up, there was a character actor my father was best friends with. His name is Johnny Seven. He played Reese on Ironside. And he was Shirley MacLaine's brother in The Apartment. He played a lot of villains.
Right.
But he was the nicest, sweetest, gentlest person. He was Italian. His real name was Johnny Fedo. And he was would never know he was a villain in the movie.
That is so true, isn't it? That's the close-up magic of acting, is that people get to know you through a character and their expectations of you are different. Like, for example, I did a lot of comedy, but then when someone meets me and I'm serious, they're like, who are you? Yeah, who are you? This doesn't compute. You have to be like your character, you know? And if you're doing a decent job of it, your job is to make that person believe for the 2 hours they're watching that that is the real you. And even if you're a villain, you need to be completely open, like I was saying earlier, vulnerable to the idea of evil inhabiting you. And what is, they're the hero in their own story. A good villain justifies what they're doing. Tate is making the city, the trains will run on time. And it'll be organized. There won't be chaos. I get my cut and I, these materials, and I protect and serve. His way of protecting and serving is basically running a gang, you know, and it's interesting, when we were writing it, there was all the problems with the police department, but it still resonates today that abuses of power are something that's fundamental. And you can use film noir to talk about a social subject like that. And Trouble certainly does talk about it, but it does it in a light adventure kind of way. But it's there. It's something that can happen.
That's funny, because he reminded me somewhat of Mussolini. So that was actually interesting. That's what came into my head.
Yeah, he is a very Mussolini-esque character.
That's cool.
Yeah, I like that. And yeah, his whole backstory is, you know, he probably was an Anzac. He was probably fighting in World War II, and a lot of people emigrated from Australia after the war, and he was used to the structure of the military. And so for him, going into the police force was just a natural progression. But then he ascended and kind of went outside of the system and had his own mini force within the force.
Yeah,
so
well-known in L.A. in the 20s and 30s was that they were pretty much on the take.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And one thing that's interesting about that is it's such a universal thing that movies let you talk about. It's just like science fiction. You can use allegory to talk about taboo subjects or subjects you want to talk about. In film noir, we live in such an affluent country that we can afford to be so cynical. And for me, what was interesting about Trouble is, how do we do this adventure? We have romance and adventure and the cynical thing, but underneath it, not much has changed in the human dynamic. People still fall in love. There's still corruption of power. And the main theme of Trouble, the stated theme, in fact, is that information is more valuable than things. And everyone spends their life pursuing things, in this case, a diamond, but the black book is priceless. And you want the information, because frankly, if he got the diamond, he couldn't buy anything with it. He'd be arrested. So the pursuit of things instead of information is more true now than ever, because look at our society. The person that controls the flow of information or controls information has power beyond any, you know, physical, tangible asset you'd have. Companies in the world don't own anything. The largest, you know, cab company in the world doesn't own any cars. The largest, you know, Airbnb owns no hotels. A search engine like Google owns no actual property and produces nothing, but they're that powerful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they own you.
And to me, that's why this movie is still relevant.
It's very relevant. But we're coming to the end of the show, so I want to give you guys a chance to tell everybody how to get the movie, and where to go, and if there's a place where they can talk to you, and if you guys are having any.
Absolutely. If you'd like to reach Brittany and I, you can send something to Twitter at New Film Noir. We would love to hear from people, particularly that saw the movie. We'd love to hear what you thought, whether you ended up watching the black and white or color. If you want to watch the movie, I would go to troubleismy.biz, B-I-Z. Couldn't believe that URL was available, but it's troubleismy.biz. It links to the streaming platforms it's on, like Fandango Now, Vudu. It's available for download on iTunes. These are worldwide. You can also get it on DVD in a double disc set and Blu-ray in color and black and white, and that's at Best Buy, Amazon. It streams on Amazon. If you go to troubleismy.biz, it breaks down everywhere that it's available, and you can pick it up there.
And did you, either of you, want to say anything in closing? Because we're really at the end.
Okay. Well, first of all, we just want to thank you so much for taking your time to have us on, because you are such a delight to talk to. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And I guess that's it for us then.
Yeah. Look for the film, and look for us doing some projects together in the future.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming on. I so appreciate it. It was lovely, and you were great. Thank you very much.
Sherry.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.